When this happened, you talked about it on The Fan.
Full windup by Simmons. And a swing on him high in the air, deep to center field, way back it may go. Gone! A grand slam! A grand slam! Mike Piazza!
When New York sports happens, talk about it here. The Fan, 101.9 FM, and always live on the free Odyssey app.
Crying loud.
McMonagle here with you on The Fan, 888-808-1019. On this Thursday morning overnight, as last night's baseball went about as well as it could have, and I'm losing my mind. I meant to take a video yesterday, the other day, the Yankee game. I know I talk about my kids a lot because it's my life, really. I've become... I'm a radio show host for 3 or 5 hours a day, and then I'm a half asleep zombie dad. That's what my life has become a year in now. Which, by the way, let me just say this. You know, I don't know why I didn't say it yesterday. I don't know if like because maybe I'm not making that big of a deal of it. But thank you guys for calling and listening, and hanging out, and interacting with me on Twitter and everything for a year now in the overnights. Starting to feel like home. So thank you guys for making it feel that way. Thank you, too, Fleegs. Although, you know, you come and go. Every time you get an opportunity to step up, you just run away from me. It's okay. I understand. But, so my life has become in this new schedule for the last year. Dealing with the kids. Yesterday we went, I had Tommy's flag football game. And by the way, let me say this, too. I don't know. I'm not trying to get political. I don't know about global warming. I'm not trying to make any case out of the last 2 weeks. But if this is the new norm of late June into July of it just being 93 degrees every day, I'm not about it. It is the absolute worst. I can't eat. I mean, we're constantly worried. Like, the kid needs to hydrate. I need to hydrate. We're sitting out there in the sun. He's baking. We're trying to play these sports. I feel terrible for him. You know, we sent them to a camp that's pretty much outside the entire day. It's like, you got to stop with the 95 degrees every stinking day. Can't even breathe outside. It's terrible. I hate this. Again, I told you, I'd rather have it be 15 degrees than 90 degrees. I can't take it. It's the worst. But I'm losing it with the Yankees because I don't know if other parents have this, especially with young kids, if you had children who are older now but younger, if you can relate to this in any way, the worst time of day. The most crazy, and I have two young boys 2 years apart, and they're best friends and worst enemies all wrapped into one. That's how it works. They're conniving schemes together to get me, at the same time diametrically opposed to each other, constantly in an endless war between the two of them. It's moment to moment whether they're teamed up together to get me and my wife, or they're at odds with each other. It's on a second-by-second basis. But the worst time of day by far is 6:30 to 8. Wind down time, relax time, bath time, bedtime. It's the worst. They are absolute maniacs in those hours. Those 2 hours, it's like, you know, the Frances, the witching hour. They become absolute monsters. Until from around 6:30 until they finally get put to bed, they are maniacs. And I got to tell you, one of the low points of my life, it felt like that. When Rodon gave up the home run yesterday, or 2 days ago now, in the first inning to Paredes, they were climbing all over me. They were screaming. They were yelling all over each other. They were doing, you know, wrestling moves and karate moves to each other, throwing pillows at each other, throwing footballs at each other, throwing Legos at each other. Just, and I'm trying to stop it all, and I can't. And I'm sitting there trying to watch both games. I've fixed the problem. If you remember this, but I haven't talked about this in a while since football season. But I have the three TVs in that room, in my living room where we hang out. And I fixed the volume problem because I bought all three Samsung, like an idiot. They're all three of the same television. and I can't figure out the volume. The one remote control controls all three, and I can't lower one and raise one without like walking up to the television and putting it right to it and covering it with my hand. So I have wireless headphones that I've connected. I have two wire. I have the TV in the middle that I just leave on, and then the two side TVs I have connected to two separate wireless headphones. And I pick up the headphones. Now, baseball, it's pretty much just the Yankees and Mets, so I only need the one headset. But during football season, I plan on having two headsets where I'll pick up it at different times. I'm crazy. I don't know what to tell you. So I'm sitting there with the headphones on my ear, trying to listen a little bit to the Met broadcast as I'm watching the Met game. I'm watching the Yankee game. They're all over me. And Rodon gives up that home run to make it 4-1 in the first inning. And I thought I was in the apex of hell. Like, honestly, I thought, I was like, this is hell. I can't control them. They're going nuts. You know, I'm literally, they're stomping on my foot just to see how bad it can hurt me. They're screaming. They're going nuts. And Rodon is spitting the bit again. And then today was the first day, and I tweeted it out. I've been very calm, and I've been very collected, and I've tried my best to not get upset about this 24 game stretch where the Yankees have been awful. They got off to a great start. I have faith they're going to turn it around. It's only July. I'm not going to get too upset about it. I'm not going to panic. This is what I've told myself. Yesterday, they needed that freaking win. They needed it desperately. And it was the first game where I couldn't sit down. They've scored two runs, right? Well, it starts with one run from Grisham that should have been a home run. I mean, the Grisham double that scores the run, I mean, it misses being a two-run home run by about an inch. It also misses just being a fly ball if a Rosarena, who looks like a shell of himself, quite honestly, but if a Rosarena makes an easy catch, they don't score any runs. So I'll take the one run. But that game had so many moments where they had runners on, the bullpen, you know, would walk. I mean, it was just every inning they had multiple guys on. Every inning there was a runner in scoring position. Every inning they were in jeopardy of this game falling apart, and you could feel it coming. Let's be honest. Over the last couple weeks, it just watching that game last night, if you're a Yankees fan, it felt like here we go about three or four times. About three or four times you said to yourself, here we go. Here we go. This is where they blow it. This is where they blow it. Whether it's you know, bringing in Hill and taking out Stroman in that situation after he walks Paredes. He pitches around Paredes in that spot. And when he does, you figure, okay, he's going to give him another batter. They talked about this because why would Stroman not try to get out of this thing on his own? Why would he pitch around and clearly walk Paredes, who they stayed away from all game? Why would you do that if you know it's going to be your last batter? And then he's bringing in the lefty, and Michael Kay is rightfully saying, considering how Cash and the Rays run their operation, that he's going to be pinch hit for by a righty, whether it's, you know, Rosario, whoever else it's going to be. And you're like, wow, now I got this guy Hill coming in to face a righty. Do I even feel better about that? At least Stroman throws sinkers. You get the ground ball. Like, I wasn't sure about it. And then he comes in. I'm like, oh, geez. And it felt like Hill's going to blow the game in the fifth. This is it. Right? Then even Weaver, you know, Hill starts the next inning, gets two guys on, a little soft ground ball that gets by the pitcher. Suddenly you got a runner on, now a base hit the other way, two guys on, nobody out. You're like, oh, here it comes, here it comes. And then he brings in Weaver, and Weaver gets out of the jam and gets a double play ball. Like, there was so many opportunities where you just felt like, here we go. And that's what made it a big win for me. And that's why it was my first pacing game. I picked up the baseball that was given to my son at the foul ball at the Atlanta Braves game a few weeks ago. And I was tossing the ball up and down and pacing in my living room while my children went crazy around me. And you know those movies where they do things like that, like where the camera would focus on the main character and he would stay in slow motion while everything else went 90 miles an hour around him? That was me. Like, if you could put the camera on me and just watching the TV, slowly pacing, flipping the ball up and down while two maniacs are running at the speed of light, knocking over couch cushions, knocking over lamps, spilling drinks, going absolutely crazy while I'm trying to focus on these two baseball games, that was me. That was me. And I'm not sure how much more I could take of it, to be quite honest with you. And so last night's win was much needed. If any of those moments would have happened, I would have lost it. Because I almost lost it when Rodon gave up the home run in the first yesterday. If they would have blown this game, if Hill comes in and gives up runs, if Weaver comes in and gives up runs, if Canely would have come in and give up runs, and then clearly if that ball in the gap from when Clay Holmes comes in and gives up immediately, you know, that line drive from Diaz in the gap that gets run down by Grisham, the minute that ball left the bat, I had my head in my hand. I was convinced it was going into the gap. Convinced. I was pretty confident Clay Holmes was going to get through it in the ninth for whatever reason. But when he came in with runners on in the eighth, I was very, very nervous. Very, very nervous. And right now, it's too much going on in that time period. That's why I used my old life when I worked in the afternoons, and again, I'll be back there tomorrow, filling in for Tiki with Evan tomorrow. In my old life, I'd come home, I'd get home around 8 o'clock, 8:30. The kids would practically be in bed already, if not at least, you know, beds immediately after they say hello and goodnight to me. I would tuck them in, kiss them goodnight, hang out, talk to my wife a little bit, and start the games at 10 o'clock at night. And it was great. Nobody was around. It was quiet. I could just watch the baseball games in peace. Now I feel like I can't do that because I got to leave to come here. Depending on how much sleep I get during the day, I might need like a quick half hour, 45 hour nap before I come in. I got to start the games when I start the games and try and finish them. I can't be waiting all night to finish the baseball games. I can't start a game at 10 o'clock. I got to be here. It's a different world. It's a different world. 888-808-1019. Now you know my experience. Come tell me yours. 888-808-1019. Let's go to Rob in the Bronx. What's up, Rob?
Hey, how's it going, man?
Good. How are you, buddy?
Good. I first of all, I just want to tell you, it goes by quick, man. It really does. I got two teenage daughters.
How old? I'm sorry. What'd you say?
I got a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old. And,
okay.
You'll definitely look back on those times and be like,
oh, no doubt. Oh, there is no doubt. I joke about that with my wife all the time. Like, in the craziness of it all, I always say to her, I'm like, in 10 years, you're going to look back at me one day and go, do you remember when they would just be like these little maniacs? Now they don't even want to hang out with us. I'm like, yeah, that's how it's going to be.
Yeah, it's
doesn't
be
change
even
the
more,
fa- it doesn't change the fact when Rodon gives up a 3-run home run. I don't need the extra aggravation in that moment, though.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you about I'm a big fan of Boone, but are we ever going to give Mattingly a chance or no?
No.
No.
Why would you want to give Mattingly a chance?
Why not?
Because he's proven not to be a very good manager. And I'm not dying. I'm not dying to give Don Mattingly the Yankee job. I just don't. Don Mattingly was a great Yankee. He was a great player. He was obviously, when I first started watching the Yankees, he was the man. We all loved him. I love him still. I think he's quite strikingly handsome with his new all white beard. I think it's a great look for him. And I'm not even kidding. I think he looks terrific. He's with the enemy right now in Toronto, but he'll always be our guy. Listen, if it happens, don't get me wrong. It's not like I would be like, how the hell could you hire Don Mattingly? But in no way, shape, or form am I seeking it out, nor do I think it's a good move. I wouldn't be overly excited about it. He went to the Dodgers and consistently underachieved. He went to Miami, let's be fair. Wasn't really given a great team, but never really, you know, did much with that Miami team. And ultimately, I watching him manage games in the playoffs and watching him manage, I don't think he was overall very good at it. I mean, he wasn't a terrible manager, but he wasn't a very good manager. You want to say, and thank you for the call, Rob, that he's better than Boone or, you know, I know there are a lot of Boone haters out there. I would not be in a rush to supplant Boone with Don Mattingly. I just wouldn't. I love Donnie Baseball. Love him. And that's the other thing, too. You don't want to. We talk about this a lot when, you know, Messier was up for the Ranger job a few years ago, or, you know, obviously Patrick Ewing for years was looking for an NBA job, and God knows the Knicks were constantly floundering with their head coaching position. I don't want to hire, like, because, and also with the Derek Jeter, for some reason people think that Derek Jeter, everyone wants the 98 Yankees to manage and coach this current team.
Jeter, the general manager, Posada, the manager, Tino Martinez, the hitting coach, David Cone, the pitching coach, Paul O'Neill, this, you know, like everyone wants the 98 Yankees to manage the Yankees. It's so stupid. But I don't want to have to, these positions are hired to be fired, unless you're Brian Cashman, of course. Ding. You get hired to be fired. I do not want to fire Don Mattingly after, you know, poor baseball or the same crap. Like, I don't want to fire Mark Messier after a couple of failing years with the Rangers. You know, it tarnishes. Like, then they come back and there'll be a generation that remembers him as the failed head coach or manager as opposed to the great player. Like, I don't know. I just, unless they are just such an overall overwhelming, terrific talent evaluator, head coach, manager, unless it's a proven fact. I mean, if Don Mattingly next year takes over the Toronto Blue Jays, or because that's where he is now, or takes over, you know, Alex Cora is rumored to be leaving, if he takes over the Boston Red Sox or wherever, and he wins and has like a couple of great years and then wants the return and it's a proven commodity that he's a great manager, I'd be open to it, I suppose. Or if Derek Jeter takes another GM job or executive job somewhere else and turns a franchise around and then, you know, wins championships and proves to be terrific at his job, would I consider it? I suppose, but I'm certainly not going to just make Don Mattingly the manager when no one else wants to. I don't know why. Like you just said, are we going to ever give Don Mattingly a chance? Why? What do the Yankees owe Don Mattingly? The Yankees don't owe Don Mattingly the head coaching job, the manager job. They don't owe him anything. Nor does he owe them. Go to Toronto. Go have your career. Go wherever you want. God bless you. And again, you look terrific in the all-white beard. I love it. It's a great look. I'm starting to think, because like my beard, if I don't even have one. I'm 40 years old. I can't grow a beard. It's pathetic. It's really pathetic. But whatever does come in, like, on the corners of underneath is almost exclusively white, where when I ever do get to grow a beard, when I'm finally older, my dad couldn't grow a beard into his late 40s either. When I finally get one, it's going to be very patchy of, it's not going to just be salt and pepper. It's going to be like black right by the chin and around my face, and then it's going to be gray underneath. It's going to be a disastrous, patchy gray and black beard that I'm, you know, going to still shave because I'm not going to shave because I'm lazy. But the all-white look, that's a look. That's a look. If you're in shape, now, if you're heavy set like me, you get the Santa Claus comparison, so you can't do it. I can't be Santa. I can't be jolly old St. Nick everywhere I go. But Don Mattingly, in great shape for his age, you want to have an all-white beard like that? Look terrific. It's a striking, jarring kind of, ooh, that's a statement right there. You put on a nice, like, dark-colored or, you know, eye-popping colored suit to go along with an all-white beard? Who's saying no? Who's saying no to Don Mattingly all dressed up in a nice, you know, navy blue suit with, like, an accent tie and an all-white beard? Who's saying no to Donnie Baseball? Not me.
When this happened, you talked about it on The Fan.
21 of the last 22 times they scored. Here's Sims to throw in third down. Up the middle, touchdown, Bavaro. Mark Bavaro goes to one knee. Genuflex in prayer. As a 13-yard throw over the middle answers the prayer for the Giants fan.
When New York sports happens, talk about it here. The Fan, 101.9 FM, and always live on the Free Odyssey app.
So, you know, I'm still fascinated by that Hard Knocks episode last night, or two nights ago now. The New York Giants, the offseason Hard Knocks, which, again, far, far more interesting than I ever thought it would be. I'm enjoying it a hell of a lot more than I really thought I would. And a couple of takeaways still from it that I didn't mention last night. You know, the Saquon Barkley thing, I talked about how that phone call, if you don't know what I'm talking about, the end of the episode was a phone call between Joe Shane and Saquon Barkley. And
my takeaway from the phone call was it just obviously felt like two guys who know it's not going to happen. It just felt like both Saquon and his, you know, what apparent, and I, again, I don't want to, this is just how it sounded to me. I can't tell you I know for sure. We sometimes speak in certainties or it comes off that way. I'm just telling you from the way it sounded to me, the disinterest from Saquon Barkley in that phone call and Joe Shane practically saying goodbye and just what we've seen, everything else in the first two episodes and just the tenor of the phone call, it felt like it was just two guys who know there's not going to be a deal between the sides and he's going elsewhere. That was the takeaway for me and Saquon Barkley specifically, who's been out there saying, want to be a Giant, want to be a Giant, want to be a Giant for the rest of my career. And I'm not saying that was never not true. I'm not saying at no point did he feel that way. I'm sure he did for a long time. I don't think he felt that way during that phone call. That's my takeaway. But I'm seeing a lot of different takeaways that I found interesting. One that I didn't think of at the time and now I'm thinking of, it's such a bad phone call from Saquon Barkley's perspective, because I do think it makes him sound disinterested, fair or unfair. It could have been the 10th time they've talked. It could have been the first time they've talked in forever. He just might have already talked to his agent and knew what was coming and felt, you know, like it was a waste of time phone call. I don't know. But you would think, I mean, without question, they had to notify him at some point that that was going to be on TV, on Home Box Office. Home Box Office! And so for him to sound that disinterested on the phone call makes me think, one, he wasn't told at the time of the phone call. And maybe he was told later, like, hey, remember that phone call we had? I'll replay it for you. I'll send you the video of it, probably. But it's going to be part of the show, if that's okay. I don't know if he has to sign off for that. I don't know how that all of that works. But my guess is if Saquon Barkley at the moment knew he was going to that was going to be televised, he might have like just had a little bit more pep in his step, but maybe not. Doesn't matter. He's already an Eagle. Doesn't matter. But a lot of people were like, oh, it's unfair. Saquon Barkley, you know, it feels like, how did they even put that on TV? Was he notified? Like, I didn't think it was so bad that it couldn't have aired or that made him look that bad. It just made it look obvious that he was willing and ready to move on. And he doesn't owe the Giants a damn thing. He doesn't owe the Giants a phone call back. In the NFL, get your money. They didn't want to give him the money he wanted to get. He got it from Philadelphia. God bless him. But that phone call has been a lot of talk, and whether or not Saquon Barkley knew about it. And then I was listening to the afternoon show, and they were calling it like cringeworthy and made and felt like Joe Shane looked bad in the phone call. Because he gave the typical, like, first of all, everybody does this. He gave the typical, how's your offseason going? You doing anything fun? Or whatever he said. You doing anything? Go anywhere? Do anything? Like, everybody says that. Everybody. I mean, let's be honest. Your doctor could call you with the results of a blood test. He'd be like, hey, so what's going on? Everything good? You had a good summer? Oh, by the way, you know, you got pink eye. I mean, everybody does that, but I mean, apparently that's cringeworthy to start the conversation off that way. He should have went right to brass tacks. He should have went right to, look, you didn't want to take the money I offered you last year, so go see if you can find it elsewhere, but then call me back. Like, of course you have the pleasantries. It's part of life. I didn't think it was a cringeworthy phone call at all. And then saying goodbye to him, I think my takeaway was that Joe Shane figured, okay, this is it. And before it gets ugly and he gives me a number that I have to tell him, no, we're not going there, let me just say nice goodbyes now while we're still on good terms. Because if he does call me back and say, look, I got the contract I got from Philadelphia, and I have to tell him, no, that's okay, go to our biggest rival, I'm not paying you that, that conversation might get real awkward, and it will be a more difficult time to tell him how much we appreciate him. I think both of them saw the writing on the wall. Saquon Barkley barely wanted to answer the phone call, and Joe Shane felt like he better say goodbye now. That's what I took from that phone call. But some of the talking points around it, whether or not Saquon Barkley knew or whether or not it was a cringeworthy moment, I don't think it was cringeworthy at all. I think it was exactly what it was. See ya. Thanks a lot. I didn't draft you. I know you didn't draft me. That's how it goes. It's a business, and he got paid a lot of money, and I have no doubt he's going to have a game where he scores multiple touchdowns against the Giants this year on their way to a 45-3 victory. I would have said one if they could score one. And I doubt they're getting a safety, so I went three. But, I mean, and then obviously the other thing, and everybody's takeaway, is the Giants were legitimately trying to move up to get another quarterback. I mean, nobody thinks it's a smokescreen. Nobody thinks it was just the Giants doing due diligence. Clearly, with all the effort they put into those meetings, meeting every single quarterback, doing all the work they did, that I don't know if the story from Rich Eisen about buyer's remorse is the word I would use necessarily, but about Daniel Jones, but clearly the New York Giants, they walked in and they talked about it in the show about being nervous that if it were the great Bill Belichick there, they wouldn't have had the nerve to go in to that room. But they clearly went over to New England to say, hey, don't do anything without talking to us. And to watch Brian Daboll and that room and give those meetings, which, again, another talking point seems to be, I'm seeing a lot of people killing Jaden Daniels for how he handled that board work. I am certainly no expert. All right, I've never been in a room like that. I couldn't draw up my favorite play. I mean, I could draw up my favorite Madden play from 10 years ago when I actually had time to play video games, but like, I can't draw up my favorite play and tell you exactly what I'm doing here and what the options are on this route. And so I'm not an expert. But I thought he handled himself very well. He knew, other than mixing up the letters F and X in one of the, you know, regurgitating the lines back to him and the play call back to him, I thought he handled that fairly well. I thought he was, and then people were getting on him for the answer to the question when he said, I'll give you this look, this, that, and what do you think I want you to do here? And he says, throw a touchdown pass. I mean, okay, it's a bit cliched. It's a bit obviously dancing around the actual question, but I thought it was a clever enough answer. I don't know. Yeah, I'll throw a touchdown pass here. And he seemed to impress everybody else because soon after all those meetings, it became very clear he was going to be the pick with Washington at number two. So a couple of weird takeaways from it, but I am so fascinated by this show, and it's got me so much more hyped. I have to admit, it's easy to get hyped for football season. Let's be honest. Football season is the greatest. We're already doing some work on our fantasy football teams. We're getting ready for football season. It's, you know, preseason games are a month away practically. We're going to be very excited. For the Giants, I don't have a lot of optimism heading into this year. But I got to tell you, watching Joe Shane, watching this head coach, looking at his offensive acumen, and I'm actually pumped he's going to be calling plays. Call me crazy. I like Kafka. I'm not disappointed. It's not like I don't think Kafka's done a good job. I'm not one of those fans. I have a couple of Giant fan buddies and football buddies who, you know, the play calling's always the problem. It's like analytics. Analytics in baseball, it's always the problem. The Yankees don't score enough runs. Analytics, they don't move the ball. They don't have productive outs. They don't care about it. It's all analytics. Analytics is every problem in baseball. And for every time in football, it's the play calling. It's always the play calling. It never fails. It never fails. That it's the reason they don't score, the reason that drive wasn't successful, was the play calling. And while I think Kafka's done a fine job play calling, I think he's done a really good job as offensive coordinator, and I don't need to tell him that or tell you that. You can learn it from the idea of how many head coaching interviews over the last 2 years. Someone who, let's be honest, most of us didn't know until he became the offensive coordinator of the Giants is suddenly out there getting head coaching interviews left, right, you know, all over the league. So I think he's done a fine job. I think he's a good coach. And I wouldn't be disappointed necessarily if he were calling plays. But this is Daboll's team. And he was brought here because he's this offensive genius. And you hear former players, and genius might be a strong word, but this offensive guru, this quarterback whisperer, he's an offensive guy. And while, yeah, sometimes that can cause problems and you want your coach to be the game manager and coach the team and not just the offense, it works just fine for Andy Reid. It works just fine for Sean McVay. It works just fine for a lot of coaches in this NFL. So for me, I love the idea that Daboll is taking over the reins. I love the idea that after last year's BS and dealing with a defensive coordinator who's disgruntled, dealing with his underlings who are spreading rumors about him and feeding leaks to the media after all the stuff about him being a forceful screamer and doing this and that, he's doubling down on it and saying, screw you. This is my team and I'm taking over the reins of the play calling. I think Kafka's done a great job, but this is my team. I want the coach to feel like it's his freaking team. And he was hired here to do just this. So do it. And watching him in those meetings, watching him go through the offense real quick, watching him, you know, pepper those quarterbacks with questions. I've been, you know, even watching him with Malik Nabers and the way he's dealing with those interviews and Adunze and dealing with the wide receivers. Just him in that room, his presence in the room. Because I got to tell you, can you imagine seeing, I would love to go see those interviews when Joe Judge was the coach. Because I don't know what Joe Judge would have said. Like, I just don't know what Joe Judge would have said. He might have been like, you know, do you think you could beat me in arm wrestling? Like, I don't know what Joe Judge would have done. But watching Brian Daboll in there talk to Nabers, talk to Adunze, talk to these quarterbacks, go over all the different plays, just his presence. It felt like, and then even like watching Joe Shane sit next to him, Joe Shane clearly acquiesced the whole thing to him. And you could see the gravitas that he has in that room. I'm pumped for Brian Daboll. I'm pumped for what he could do this year with this team. And again, I'm really hopeful, because as much as I get on Daniel Jones, and as much as I'm tired of having the year of Daniel Jones, which was the final quote of episode one of Hard Knocks, this is the sixth year of the year of Daniel Jones. I mean, it's gone on forever. I am hopeful that they can get something out of him, and I'm hopeful that he can be something, but if he's not, what's really going to bother me is that Brian Daboll might leave as the Giants head coach. His tenure might end without ever getting his hands on his guy, his hand-picked quarterback, the guy he wanted to draft, the guy he wanted to develop, the guy he personally saw something in. Because right now, I have as much faith in him as I have as with anybody in the organization, players included. And I'm going to be bummed if Brian Daboll goes through this and loses with Daniel Jones and has to get fired and never has an opportunity to develop, draft, and build his guy. Because I feel like he's going to do it somewhere and he's going to be successful. And instead, we're playing this, can Daniel Jones be the guy? And we got an owner who I respect, but we got an owner who is hung up on making it work with Daniel Jones. When they hired Brian Daboll and Joe Shane, we've done everything to ruin this kid. I really hope he gets a chance. Now Saquon Barkley has to leave. I'll be sick to my stomach when Saquon Barkley leaves. We're holding on to players who have done nothing for them. We're sick to our stomach and focused on making sure the players who have done nothing but lose with the New York Giants stay New York Giants. Because they're good guys. Because they're quality individuals. And that does go a long way, no doubt. But this is the NFL, and you have to produce, and you have to win. And when you hire a coach who develops quarterbacks, and you stick him with Daniel Jones, year six, coming off a blown-out knee, and a neck injury every other year, are you really utilizing and taking the best, you know, and are you utilizing and getting the most out of an offensive coach you brought here? When you hamstring him with a quarterback who I don't know if can be successful. It's frustrating. Let's get back to the calls. 888-808-1019. 888-808-1019. Val in the Bronx. What's up, Val?
Brother Mac, what's going on this morning,
Doug? What's going on, buddy? How are you?
I'm all right. I want to talk to you about a couple of things, but before I get into that, I got one thing to say to you. I don't know if you're familiar, but, and I don't know if you'll get this, Chris Ham, have you ever heard any of the comedy specials by that guy? I think it's Dunham. Is it Bill or Jeff Dunham?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, the guy with the puppets. Yes, I definitely know him.
Yeah, and he got the one puppet that's always like Dunham. Chris Hand.
Are you going
to...
Val, wait, hold on.
I'm not going to do that for the whole quote.
No, wait. I can't let it go, though. What are you calling... am I Chris Ham? Like,
Grisham.
Oh, Grisham. Okay, I got you.
Grisham.
I wasn't hearing you right. Okay, I got you. Yes. Last night was the game of Grisham, no doubt. He drove in both runs and saved the game, yeah?
Yeah, you know, I felt like I was listening. I was in and out, so I don't know if anybody else made the point. But I felt I got 2 points for you, but I felt very much the same way that you did. That two runs thing, man, it was nice to get the win. And you know how I feel about that. When you do those kind of like, you know, you do it by the book to the closer, da 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 da, this, that, there, and you squeak it out.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of wins like that.
Yep.
But at the same time, that two run stuff, because I was just like you, I was edgy the whole time. I'm like, we need more than this.
Oh, of course.
You know, I was looking for those insurance runs or something like that to help us out, because I kept feeling just like you did that Tampa was on the cusp of either tying it up or taking the lead.
Every inning.
You know?
Every inning they're on the cusp of blowing the game open. It was a nerve-wracking game considering how badly they needed it.
There you go. But to get to the real point, you know, it's interesting. On a day like today, right, when Grisham is the one that gets both runs to the plate and gives us the two runs that we need.
Right.
When Grisham is the guy that does the defensive – the big defensive play that everybody is talking about, that everybody wants to ask the question about in the postgame. I'm interested, and again, like I said, I was in and out because I was on the train and I'm listening to the Odyssey app, and every time I put it back on, it just brings me back to what was the last thing I heard. So I don't know if you heard, if there was a call that I missed where somebody might have said it. But has anybody called you tonight to give Aaron Boone any kind of credit for possibly maybe that talk that he might have had with Grisham after the faux pas that might have caused him to be focused on a night like tonight where he does actually come out and make the play like he did today? Like, you don't hear anything about that. When Grisham and these guys do stuff like that, it's like, oh, well done, Grisham, well done.
No.
And as soon as he, you know, slips someplace, Boone, what are you doing? You didn't talk to this guy?
Val.
Like, did I miss a call?
Val, you know
did,
you
did. Did somebody call?
You know damn well, Val, that nobody called me and gave Boone credit. You know that.
I was trying to give
you
it the benefit of the doubt.
You know damn well, Val, that nobody called me and gave Aaron Boone an ounce of credit. Not for whatever happened with Grisham where he had this great game, which, honestly...
Not for the bullpen moves, none of that, right?
Not for the... That's more of the issue to me. I mean, yeah, listen, I don't know what he said to Grisham, but, I mean, I think this is more of the norm of Grisham. I mean, I know he had the double, but that defensive play...
Grisham's a
Gold Glove caliber center fielder. I don't think Boone needed to talk to him necessarily to have him
and
make that great play,
too.
But the bullpen decisions yesterday. Now, it could have easily went the other way. Don't get me wrong. I think,
I was a little bit scary with Holmes.
Yeah,
Well,
I mean, yeah, but the thing is we kill him every time. Right, the story of the game. If Hill comes in and gives up a double and loses the game in the fifth,
I really like that kid.
If that's what happens, every call is Boone's an idiot. What is Boone thinking? How do you not leave in Stroman? How do you go to this bum Hill? That's the story. That Boone ruined the game. Any one of those moves he made last night doesn't work out. Boone's the idiot and ruined the game. But nobody will call me and say, "Wow, you got to admit, as much as I may dislike him, as much as I'm fed up with his antics in the postgame, got to admit, Boone pulled every right string last night and pushed every right button. And I mean, he brought in the guy to get out of every single jam. He brings in Weaver, boom, double play. He brings in, Hill, obviously, as we said, to take over for Stroman against the lefty. Everyone expects Cash to counter with a right-handed hitter. He doesn't. Three straight fastballs, 1-2-3, gets out of that inning. I mean, every single move Boone made yesterday was the right one, and no one's going to give him credit. And furthermore, the next time Boone pisses them off and makes a move they don't like, they will say...
They forget all about that.
They'll forget all about last night and say he never makes the right move. He's always wrong. They'll never play it 50-50. Like, it's just the way it is. That's how it goes.
And I got one more thing for you.
Yeah.
All right? One more thing, and then I'm gone. Saturday night, when Rice had the three homer day and everything, I really thought that was like a vengeance game, where it was like, you know what, the Yankees came out and we were like, everybody feel my wrath. Now, you know, it's hell to pay. We're about to go on a run. But sometimes, and I've heard this so many times over the years, either watching a game or listening to a game, there's a guy that comes up and he's slumping. And he's trying every little thing, you know, every at bat before that, maybe he, you know, he's, you hear them talking about, oh, he's making good contact, he's pushing it to the opposite side of the field, but it was just unlucky, it was a fly ball or whatever, And there's always that one time when there'll be that guy that gets like an infield hit where, like, it could be like even a guy that's a power hitter, but he gets that one little thing, like, you know, some squeaker that just kind of just barely makes it to first, he runs out something or something like that. And you hear the announcer say something like, this might be the one, because, and you know, you're just looking for anything, just something to get the bricks off your shoulder. Yeah. And this might be the one that does it. Maybe the 2-1 instead of the 14
yep.
run game,
Val,
maybe the 2-1 is the one that is the one that,
taking,
that like takes the bricks off your shoulder.
You can go
you
back,
know what I mean?
You can go back and listen on the rewind. You're taking the words right out of my mouth from my open. I completely agree with you. We've seen Victor.
Have a great morning, brother.
You got it, Val. Thank you very much for the call. We have seen in the handful of victories they've had over the last 3 weeks, and that's all it's been, a handful. We've seen blowouts, really. We've seen the big 16-run game in Toronto. You saw the outburst, the 10-run outburst against the Red Sox on that Saturday he's referring to when Ben Rice hit 3 home runs. You've seen a couple of laughers, which you were hoping would get them in the right direction, whether it was that game in Toronto especially because it had everybody. It had 3 hits from Verdugo. It had Gleyber Torres with a home run. It had, you know, all the little things you're looking for. It answered a lot of questions. It gave you a little bit of hope. And that led to nothing. And then Saturday led to nothing. I think it was important to win one of these close games. This was a game because it's one thing when you just pound the starting pitcher or you hit a bunch of home runs, you score a ton of runs. Okay. This was a game where they were tested. This is a game where, yeah, you would love the offense to do more than score 2 runs, both RBIs coming from Grisham on a double and a sac fly. But as much as you'd love to score more runs, you also want to get tested. You want your bullpen to have to come through because that's been a major – the pitching has really been the downfall. We could talk about the offense, and by no means has it been good. But the downfall of this Yankee team and the main difference between the first half and what we've seen – the first 2 months and what we've seen over the last month – has really been the pitching, the starting pitching in particular, but all the pitching has been, it went from being the thing that was carrying them to an out-and-out disaster. I mean, Rodon's a completely different pitcher. Luis Gil, up until this last start against the Red Sox, was a completely different pitcher. Like, they had fallen off. They'd completely fallen apart, and the bullpen's been terrible. The Yankees, as I think Jack Curry said it yesterday, in the post game, not this last game, the first game against Tampa Bay in the post game, that the Yankees offense during this stretch of losing is 10th in the is 10th in Major League Baseball in runs scored. I mean, they're middle of the pack. They're not like the bottom of the barrel. Or even if it's 10th in the American League, that's still 6 teams behind them. I thought it was 10th in Major League Baseball. I'll double check. But the offense hasn't been like never score any runs, awful. Now, some of those runs have been an outburst. Like I said, 10 and 16 runs in 2 different games. We know the offense is struggling. I'm not trying to paint a picture of anything else. I'm just saying it's really been the pitching. And so for the bullpen to come through in the way it did, for 2 runs to stand up, for Clay Holmes to get that final out when he couldn't the other night against Boston, to, you know, he hasn't had a save in over a month. To win that tight game, I'm hoping. I can't tell you it will. I'm not. I can't predict the future. I don't know. But I'm hoping that is a little bit more of a, wow, we've turned the corner. We're over the hump. That was a game we've lost every time over the last 25 games. That's a game we typically lose to Tampa. Right? On a night you score, you have, you know, your leadoff hitter hit 3 home runs and you score 10 runs, or you pound the Blue Jays and score 16 runs, you'll always win that game. Those games happen and you win them. What about when the game's on the line? What about when you have 3 consecutive innings with runners in scoring position with a 1-run lead and you get out of it? What about that tightly contested game that you need to make the big-time double play? You need to make the run and catch in the alley to save the game. And you make every play you need to make and you win a close contested game when you haven't done so in a month. I'm hoping that's the kind of game that can spark this Yankee team. I'm hoping that's a bigger positive than the offensive explosion that we've seen a couple of times during this miserable stretch. And hopefully that is something that can, you know, get the Yankees going here. Maury in Belmore. What's up, Maury? Tonight is your night, bro.
Tonight is your night, bro. Loving the show as usual, my friend.
Thank you, my friend.
Quick points first on the Yankees. You're so right, because I kept checking. 2-1. Are we going to lose 3-2? You're right. This is a game that we needed to win. I want to thank Boone for making the right decisions. Obviously, we beat the snots out of him every day.
Yes.
But let's go. Let's slowly just get back into this thing, start winning again, go through the All-Star break, get the bullpen back to normal. The pitching has been from, I think, 2 to 3 ERA to 7 over the last 20 games. So it's definitely the starting pitching. Let's turn it around. That's all I can say.
Yeah, no, listen, tonight's the most important game of the season. We'll probably say that another 40 or 50 times throughout the year. But right now, this game tonight, to take a series, to finally win a series, they haven't won a series. They're 0-6-1 in the last 7 series. They have not won a series since June 12th. We're going on a month that they have not won a series. They need to win a series heading into this Baltimore series, which will then Friday night be the biggest game of the year. That's how it works. But they need to win this game tonight. Otherwise, everything I just said is noise and forgotten about and goes out the window. All that I hoped about the momentum, the bullpen, the catch from Grisham, the throwing out a runner for the first, getting their first stolen base. Thank you, Juan Soto. Which, by the way, is a ridiculously overblown stat. There's not the idea that they went 21 games, the longest stretch since 1961 or 62, without a stolen base, considering they've made it easier for stolen bases with the new rules. It's not that there's nothing to that. The Yankees don't have a lot of guys who can steal bases. The Yankees, we get it. I think they are a little bit more athletic than they've been with defensively and, you know, in other ways. But they're not necessarily base stealers. But the point is, and I said it a week ago when the stat first showed up, and Boone said it in his weekly interview with John Boy, they're down 4 or 5 runs every night. Their starting pitching is getting rocked in the first inning. Think of all the games that they've been down 5, 6 runs before the game even gets underway. You don't steal bases down 4 or 5 runs. It limits your options to do so. You're not going to risk outs when you're down that many runs. They haven't been put in the position. Now, look, 21 straight games without one, I'm not saying it's insignificant. I'm saying it's not this devastating stat that everybody seems to think it is. It's not proof of how terrible they are on the base paths. There's something to it. That's a lot of games without a stolen base, particularly in the new age of the last few years with the new rules. And you would think just Volpe alone would get one here or there, and his home runs have gone down, his stolen bases have gone down, his OPS has gone down. I mean, he's really struggling in every aspect of his game. But I don't think that's some sort of telltale sign or some sort of stat that is some referendum on how the Yankees have built a roster or how the Yankees go about business. It's more about the starting pitching. They're down 5-4. They're down big runs every game. You're not going to risk outs on the base path when you're down 5 runs in the 5th inning. You steal a base when you're down a run. You steal a base when you're down 2 runs. You steal a base when you're up and you want to be aggressive. You don't steal a base when you're down multiple runs. That's just baseball. And unfortunately, over the last month, they've been down 4 or 5 runs on a nightly basis. So, I mean, some stats are telling and some stats are misleading. And then some stats are just a sign, but not necessarily a referendum. And that's where that one falls for me. 888-808-1019, 888-808-1019. But yes, a big game, and a big game for the Mets as well, as now you want to get greedy as you head into this All-Star break. They're now a half a game out of the wild card. The next time I talk to you tomorrow morning at 2 a.m., the Mets could be in a playoff spot. They could be holding the third wild card spot. They got a game against Washington and then a 3-game set against the lousy Colorado Rockies. This Met team that had floundered so amazingly to start the year, who started 0-5 and already in the 6th game of the year had Gary Cohen calling it the low watermark. What do you say? Rock bottom, excuse me. Rock bottom. You were already at rock bottom game 6. You fell apart. The season was over. idiots like me were calling you dead after that 10-game homestand, after the meeting. All of that has turned around to the point where all it is one more game against Washington and a 3-game set against the lousy Colorado Rockies in your building heading into the All-Star break to give you a legitimate opportunity to be a playoff team. What the Mets have done here, watching Iglesias, you know, celebrate with all the OMG signs and everything else that's come along with it, but watching him do what he's done, watching Nimmo hit 3 home runs in consecutive days, watching Vientos look like he gets jammed and shooting one 380 feet to the right center field wall. I mean, just everything about this team and everything about this offense has just been so impressive and so much fun that they are making a real case where this general manager has to rethink his strategy that he had heading into the season. And they've done it with a month to go, with, you know, 3 weeks to go, 2 weeks to go. It's time to make that decision. And so these 4 games left for the Mets are imperative. They can't lose this series against Colorado. You don't want, I mean, now you get greedy. You've won the first two. Let's take the next four. Because now you don't want to go backwards. This has to be the low water mark of the rest of the first half. Like, you can't be worse than this. The New York Mets can't be worse than a half a game out come the All-Star game, or else they just didn't do their job.